This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There was another oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. Today it turned out to be a very scary false alarm. There's an expensive hurricane coming to the East Coast, and the labor market is still shaky too. But there is some good news, I promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 2nd of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us. This morning, a commercial helicopter flying out over the Gulf of Mexico spotted something I'm very sure the crew would rather not have seen, an explosion on an oil rig off the coast of Louisiana. Turns out to have been much less of a story than everybody feared at first, but Marketplace's Eve Troy reports it is still not what anybody needed.
A fire broke out on a shallow water oil and gas rig owned by Mariner Energy, based in Houston. The Vermilion rig sits about 100 miles off the coast of Louisiana. It's about 200 miles west of where BP's Deepwater rig blew up in April. All 13 crew members escaped this blast by jumping in the water. They were rescued, but the rig kept burning for hours. The company says it wasn't oil or gas from the wells burning, but rather something flammable stored up top. The rig was not in production. It was shut down for maintenance. The cause of the explosion remains unknown. The Coast Guard reported an oily sheen on the water, 100 feet wide and more than a mile long. That led government officials to close down fishing areas and make plans to contain the oil. But now the Coast Guard says there is no sheen and no trace of spilled oil. Still, the incident may hurt Louisiana's push for the White House to lift its moratorium on deepwater drilling in the Gulf. Local leaders say thousands of workers could lose their jobs if the moratorium remains in place. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Over to the banking sector now, where one of the most hated phrases of the financial crisis is back with us: too big to fail. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke told the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission this morning that no bank that gets in trouble, no matter how big or how interconnected they may be, should be let off the hook.
There has to be a credible way to let firms fail, in fact, require that they fail.
That's great, but here's the catch. Big banks have only gotten bigger since Lehman Brothers went under. So members of the commission were dubious, shall we say, that regulators would let a firm controlling hundreds of billions of dollars just fail. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Two bank regulators told the commission today that too big to fail is no longer possible. In testimony before the same commission, FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair said that thanks to Wall Street reforms, regulators can no longer bail big banks out. Commission Chairman Phil Angelides seemed a little skeptical.
Do you really believe at this point that the market believes that the too big to fail doctrine has been broken?
Well, I think it's up to us to effectively implement the new authorities that Congress has given us. The statute very specifically prohibits any kind of open institution assistance. So if it happens, it's going to have to be Congress doing it.
But lawmakers may be challenged because there's already a precedent for propping up big banks, says Mary Botari at the Center for Media and Democracy.
I find it very difficult to believe that if a giant institution that threatens the entirety of the U.S. economy was on the brink of collapse, that regulators and Congress wouldn't try and rush to aid them in any way they could.
During the crisis, the government did let two big banks fail, Lehman Brothers and Washington Mutual. But after that, regulators got cold feet, says Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics.
Those two failures were the bondholders went into bankruptcy. The establishment, if you will, in all of the industrial countries reacted in horror. They just said, oh, can't do this anymore.
Whalen says the U.S. has to decide whether to protect big banks like Europe or return to a free market where banks succeed or fail on their own. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There was a big buyout on the corporate radar screen today. You might even call it a whopper. The private equity firm 3G Capital snapped up Burger King for about $4 billion. That's 46% more than the company's stock was worth. Speaking of stock, the deal means that Burger King won't be publicly traded anymore. It's going private for the second time in 8 years. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
Burger King has been hammered by the downturn. Steve West, an analyst with Stifel Nicolaus, says part of the problem is Burger King bet on its best customers, lower-income young men. They've been hit hard by unemployment. West says going private could help BK invest in widening its appeal.
So they can take on more debt, reinvest that in the brand to an extent that the current management team wasn't really able to do because it was a publicly traded company and it would be frowned upon.
West says Burger King can use that money to spruce up its stores, which average about 20 years old. But Sanford Bernstein analyst Sarah Senator is skeptical.
Burger King has already been owned by private equity companies, so the idea that there would now be an opportunity to take it private and really fix this business, it's a little surprising that somebody would see that.
Senator says Burger King is working to appeal to more customers, like partnering with Twilight to draw in young women. And the new private owners could borrow and not invest in improving the company, says analyst Steve West.
They could do what the last private equity group did, just pay themselves a nice little dividend with that money.
That debt is one of the reasons Burger King can't borrow as a public company now. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There is, amazingly enough, more news from the mergers and acquisitions front today. One bidding war wound down, another one heated right up. Dell bowed out of its battle with Hewlett-Packard over the data storage company 3PAR. HP came in with a winning bid of almost $2.5 billion. Over in rental car land, meanwhile, Avis and Hertz are still going at it over Dollar Thrifty. Today, Avis bumped its offer up to $1.3 billion. Marketplace's Janet Babin explains.
Here's why Avis and Hertz are fighting over Dollar Thrifty, even in a recession.
Dollar Thrifty has continued to actually outperform its competitors.
That's Neil Abrams of Abrams Consulting Group. He says Dollar Thrifty focuses on budget-conscious leisure travelers. Hertz is geared to business and upscale travelers, so the acquisition could generate millions of new rental customers for Hertz. Avis already has a budget brand, so why is it willing to pay a premium for Dollar Thrifty?
They don't want Hertz to get it.
Abrams says Avis and Hertz have always been fierce competitors. While the recession has hurt many travel-related industries, the rental car business has held up. With fewer customers, companies were able to trim their fleets, their biggest expense. The recession also strengthened the used car market, so companies like Hertz and Avis can make money selling their old cars. Christopher Elliott blogs about travel. He says a more consolidated industry will be bad for consumers.
Before, there might have been more competition. Now there's less competition. So we can expect to pay higher rates, I think.
The Dollar Thrifty acquisition is subject to antitrust approval from the government. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The news that drove Wall Street today isn't actually coming out till tomorrow morning. Traders were waiting on the August unemployment report pretty much all day. Fears that it might be grim had them sitting on their hands. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of Americans have 401k retirement plans these days. They are what are called defined contribution plans. You and most times your company put money in, and there's a nice little nest egg when you retire if the economy and the markets have been okay. But if you've been working for a government, local, state, or federal, chances are you're looking forward to a decent pension no matter what. Those pensions, they're called defined benefit plans, are paid out regardless of what the markets and the economy do. Right now, the governments that have to pay those pensions aren't doing so well finance-wise. So they are looking to public employees and taxpayers to help them out of an ever-deepening pension hole. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
How bad is it right now? The Pew Center on the States reports pension funds are short at least $1 trillion, says managing director Sue Yu Ran. And that doesn't even include all the investment losses from the recession.
States have a tendency to set benefit levels, know that it is a future cost, and decide to worry about it tomorrow.
Governments did agree to these pensions in union contracts, often because it was cheaper than big pay increases. Now they can't afford the annual contribution.
For example, if you look at California, $12 billion, payments as significant as that begin to compete with the other kinds of things states would like to spend those revenues on.
California might not have to furlough so many state workers or raise tuition as much if it could save on pensions. And the state is trying. In a deal with unions, new state employees will pay more into the system and get lower benefits at retirement. That'll save money down the road, but cutting back on benefits already promised by contract to current workers and retirees, legally, that's a lot harder. Other states have tried it and faced lawsuits. Cities and counties often run their own pension funds, and they're in trouble too.
We knew the bubble was going to burst at some point, and it burst.
I'm meeting Ventura County Supervisor Peter Foy at an upscale Spanish-style mall in Simi Valley, a suburb of L.A. His county's pension fund lost a third of its value in the recession.
We're in trouble because we have to make up the difference between what we're paying benefits and what that shortfall is.
And that's taken a toll on services. There's a hiring freeze, 500 vacant positions, including in the sheriff's department. And county workers, who haven't gotten a raise in years, now contribute 3% of pay to the pension fund. Foy would like to raise the retirement age and have voters approve future pension increases for government workers. Given how much everyone else's retirement has suffered in the recession, he thinks public opinion's on his side.
We need to be making sure that people aren't getting excessive pay because labor unions are pushing them harder and getting extra benefits that the average person doesn't get.
I head to the Ventura County Fair, and here it's not hard to find taxpayers who are fed up. Holly Barnes is retired from the phone company.
I also have family that has worked for the government, county, federal, and I think the public, if they really had any idea, would be appalled. They make more money sometimes when they're retired than when they're working.
Of course, many retirees don't see anything like that kind of money. Debbie Dames came to the county fair for $1 admission day. She was a city clerical worker making $40,000 when she retired last year.
My monthly salary now is about a little over $1,800.
And is that what your whole family at this point is living on, you and your husband?
We are right now because my husband just got laid off. I am going to go back to work to help our family out.
Dames worries the state will cut her benefits to shore up its pension fund. But as she says, she can try to find another job. After 30 years with the government, she retired at the ripe old age of 54.
It is a real problem.
County Supervisor Peter Foy.
I think it's critical that we ask people to work a normal work career. She lives to be 100 years old. That pension is being paid.
These days, workers are also contributing more to pay for those pensions. Jesse Guzman helps administer health and welfare benefits for county residents. His wife cleans rooms in a county hospital.
I figure it's about maybe $4,500 we're being cut a year, and we definitely notice it.
They've pulled their kids out of daycare and aren't helping others as much either.
We're not contributing to our church as much as we used to in order to offset that decrease in income.
Guzman says he's okay with that loss in income as long as the county pension is sound and can pay what it promised when he retires. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, so here's today's Marketplace pop quiz. You ready? What do Sachs, Borders Books, and Northrop Grumman have in common? If you answered that they've all announced layoffs in the past month, go ahead and give yourself a gold star. Job losses are the story of this recession. But commentator and New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt says we are ignoring a major plot line here.
These recent layoffs, among others, might be considered symbols of the economy's struggles. But as symbols go, they happen to be a little misleading. Layoffs are not the job market's main problem today, and they were not the main problem during our Great Recession. On the first Friday of each month, like tomorrow, the Labor Department releases its jobs report. That report tells us how many jobs, on net, the economy gained or lost in the previous month. For August, forecasters are expecting a loss of more than 100,000 jobs. Whatever the number is, it will hide much, much larger numbers of hirings and firings in any given month. Lately, about 4 million of each. Think of it this way. The economy may have created 4 million new jobs, but it also eliminated 4.1 million old jobs, leading to a net loss of 100,000 jobs. When you dig into these statistics on hiring and firing, you see that firing hasn't been the issue recently. Hiring has. Even at the depths of the Great Recession in early 2009, the firing rate was still lower than it had been during the comparatively mild 2001 recession. The hiring rate, on the other hand, plunged 25% between 2007 and 2009. That rate has rebounded somewhat since then, but remains rather low. Throughout much of the last decade, in fact, the hiring rate has been falling. It's easy to look at today's economy and to think that there is too much change, too much flux. Really, however, there is not enough change. It appears that we haven't been making the investments that can create lots of jobs. Educational attainment has slowed in recent decades. The federal government has cut its commitment to scientific research and other investments, the kind that created the interstate highway system, the moon landing, and a Pentagon project we now know as the Internet. Corporate investment has failed to fill the void. So the next time you hear one of those layoff announcements, remember that it's only half of the jobs equation. And it's not the half that is likely to determine how quickly the economy returns to health.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. You can send us your take on the economy or anything else you like. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, things change once you turn 30, you know.
She is fashionable, which is definitely not what I remember Strawberry Shortcake being.
But first, let's do the numbers. After wavering near the center line most of the day, the Dow Industrials staged a late afternoon rally today, added 50 points, about a half percent, closed at 10,320. The NASDAQ gained 23 points, a little more than 1%, finished at an even 2,200. The broader S&P 500 rose 9 points, just shy of 1%, wrapped up trading at 1,090. Given weeks of gloomy news, one analyst summed up the day this way: doesn't take much to get people happy now, does it? Retail numbers weren't spectacular, but they were better than expected. That was enough to lift Costco shares more than 1%. Stock in Macy's tacked on 2.5%. JCPenney cashed in a 3% gain. Limited Brands added 6%. An unexpected rise in pending sales of existing homes shored up home builders. D.R. Horton and Pulte Group both advanced around 2.5%. Lennar Homes grew 1.75%. Investors had a sudden appetite for a Whopper. News in that Burger King buyout we mentioned earlier heated up shares in the fast food chain by 25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for August. It's billed as the world's largest trade show for consumer electronics and home appliances. IFA opens in Berlin. A presentation on 3D entertainment kicks things off. Groovy glasses provided. Don't want to travel that far? The annual Oatmeal Festival begins in Bertram, Texas. Yes, there is a cook-off. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It is going to be a lousy Labor Day weekend all up and down the eastern seaboard. Hurricane Earl's coming. Surf, wind, rain, and according to one risk forecasting firm, anywhere from $100 million to $500 million in damages. That is not by any stretch of the imagination small change, but it's also not as high an estimate as you might expect for a storm this big. The risk consulting firm Equicat gave us that number. Bill Keough is the senior vice president there. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This $100 million figure that you are forecasting for potential losses from this hurricane, how do you know? I mean, where'd that number come from?
The simple version is three processes. First, we have to know, where is the event going to strike? Second, we want to know, what's it going to hit? And third, we want to know, what's the insured value of the things that it's going to hit?
For the what's it going to hit part, do you guys have, I mean, do you know, like the buildings are masonry here and steel construction there and wood frame there? I mean, are your models that precise?
Understanding the insured building stock is a very important aspect of building models and something that our clients use. So we use many sources, both public and proprietary, to come up with a view of what the insured properties look like in all the hurricane states in the U.S.
My guess would be that you would prefer not to use words like accuracy. You know, we can predict with 77% accuracy. You're providing estimates, right? Considered estimates.
Exactly. What we're trying to do is set rational expectations about the risk, and there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty involved in coming up with these estimates. So, for instance, there's uncertainty of the track, of the intensity, and the wind field of the event. And then for the building, the buildings have different responses. A wood frame building getting hit by peak gust winds of 120 miles an hour might have 30% damage, or it could have 70% damage.
Yeah, it's a pretty big window there, 30 to 70%.
It is.
And you just sort of have to live with that if you're in the insurance and risk forecasting business?
The most important thing that we do is we capture and express the uncertainties. It's more about making sure that we're understanding, acknowledging, and expressing all the uncertainties involved in the estimates so that we understand the full range of possibilities.
So it's a very big what-if question, right?
It is. But, you know, it's better than nothing. So, you know, we
now there's a sales pitch.
Well, it you know, models are very useful tools. And
right.
As long as you understand that it's a tool, you can use it intelligently. If you think it's reality, that's where you get lost.
Now, as for the companies who might use this data to estimate the risk that they face, and I'm thinking now of insurance companies, I mean, what do they do with your data once they get it?
One of the things they might do is use this information to help deploy claims agents. The sooner you can get to a loss and help mitigate and pay the claims, the better off your client will be. They'll also be using it to come up with a loss estimate for themselves to understand and have expectations for how large is this going to be for us, how much impact will this be for us, so they can communicate it to various stakeholders like shareholders, regulators, and insurers.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're in New Jersey, right? It's conceivably in the path of this storm, yes?
Yes.
So how's your insurance? You good?
I think we're good.
All right. Bill Keough at the strategic risk consulting firm Equicat. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Time and business opportunities wait for no one. That's the lesson to take out of this next story. I can't actually remember this myself, but I'm reliably told that back in the early 1980s, there was a doll that was especially big. Strawberry Shortcake, she was called. To celebrate her 30th anniversary, Hasbro has gone and given her a makeover and sent her off to Comic-Con to win some new fans, and in the process, totally messing with Sally Herships memories of her childhood.
This is the Strawberry Shortcake I remember.
Wow! My shortcake recipe won! I've been selected as one of two finalists in a big bake-off!
In case you don't know her, Strawberry Shortcake, the doll, wears a pinafore with green and white striped tights. She looks sweet, like Raggedy Ann. I'm a big fan, so when I found out about her makeover, I was excited. Until I saw the new doll. She has super long hair, a pink miniskirt, and plays a strawberry-shaped guitar. Not who I think of as Strawberry Shortcake. I went to talk to Cassie Mogilner. She's a marketing professor at Wharton now, but when she was little, she had Strawberry Shortcake sheets. I asked her what she thought of Strawberry's new look.
She is fashionable, which is definitely not what I remember Strawberry Shortcake being.
What do you think the 1980s Strawberry would say if she saw
the Comic-Con special limited edition strawberry shortcake?
I think she'd be intimidated by her and probably wouldn't even approach her in the playground because she's too cool. I wouldn't say hot because she still looks young, but she's definitely grown up a bit.
I asked Hasbro, which makes strawberry shortcake, why they were going with this new look. They said they wanted to appeal to contemporary kids, so I decided to talk to some. I checked in with kids at Comic-Con, where the new doll made her debut. Charlotte and Abigail, and Christina, who's a bit older, are fans.
I want the new one because I like it.
I think the new look's a lot cuter than the old look because it just has more accessories and it's just overall cuter. And the head's a lot smaller.
It still has that essence of strawberry shortcake. It smells, it still has the pink and the red. She looks like the traditional doll just grown up into the modern age.
So maybe Strawberry's new look is working for her. Cassie Mogilner says it's all about making sure the essence of her brand stays intact.
All the thoughts and feelings, all the associations that come to mind when you hear the brand's name or you see the brand's logo.
But successfully changing a brand while keeping old customers loyal isn't easy. Tim Calkins is a professor of branding at Kellogg School of Business. He told me about a classic example of a brand change gone wrong. Oldsmobile. This is not your father's Oldsmobile. This was a new slogan meant to attract new customers. I'll let Calkins tell you why this campaign bombed.
The problem, of course, was that the cars didn't change dramatically, so people looked at them, the young people did, and they said, well, that actually is my father's Oldsmobile.
And then the older customers said, well, I guess it's not my brand anymore.
And then all of a sudden, now you've lost everything, right? Because you lost the old folks, you didn't resonate with the young people, and you basically just killed it.
I wouldn't want that to happen to Strawberry Shortcake. So I asked Calkins if he had any advice for her rebranding.
Strawberry Shortcake is who she is. But by the same token, I think she can get out every once in a while. I guess it's okay to come out from under your strawberry on occasion. Just don't go too far from home.
Has Strawberry gone too far from home for me? When I look at the new doll, I have mixed feelings. Part of me wants her to stay who she was. But I guess if she's going to make it in the modern world, she has to change with the times. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out this afternoon, another in our continuing series of me getting my head around how Twitter can actually be useful sometimes. Saw an interesting item on Forbes.com today. Commodities traders in the Midwest, the folks who trade grains mostly, have started following farmers' Twitter feeds. They apparently get early tips on crop condition, weather, all the stuff that helps them make money, which is kind of cool, actually. So score one for Twitter, a demerit for me. I know. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow up 50 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 23 points, better than 1%. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, not quite 1%, waiting on tomorrow's unemployment report. Everybody was. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, say hello to high-tech fashion.
They have lights embedded into the fabric in a way that you don't even notice that there's technology there. So if you wear it, it feels like a normal shirt.
No wires, no nothing. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.